We're joined live in the KODX studios by Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Another stellar week here in the crumbling empire. And
lucky nothing much happened this week.
Well, hopefully we won't have to make anything up to fill in the space.
No.
So starting out with the city council, they are back at it.
Yeah, they passed some tenants' rights bills this week. Five bills that were introduced by Lisa Herbold were passed out of committee this week. One would protect survivors of domestic abuse from having to pay for damage to rental units caused by their abusers. The city will set up a fund to pay mitigation fees for this type of damage up to $1,000 per claim if a landlord's liability insurance denies their claim. The rental unit must be registered with the city's inspection program, and the damage must be repaired first before the city will pay the claim. The second bill restricts landlords' ability to limit roommates and family members who can share a unit. Immediate family members can room with you without having to be on the lease, but that doesn't include anyone that you've lived together with in the past as an adult, like an ex-boyfriend or ex-spouse, for example. And you will still have to notify the landlord if an immediate family member is sharing the unit with you. The third bill requires landlords to accept non-electronic forms of payment, like cash and paper checks, and to provide receipts. The fourth bill requires landlords to register their apartments under the city's rental registration and inspection ordinance before they can issue any tenant a notice to terminate a lease or a tenancy. Currently, the landlord has to register their apartment before a judge can issue an order for eviction. That's the current law. This just pushes it back so that before the landlord can issue a notice to the tenant, they have to register with the city. Now, the fifth bill requires that landlords include a statement in notices that they send to tenants informing them of where they can access information about their rights under the law. Currently, that's landlords are required to do that when you first move in or when you sign a new lease, not every time they give you a notification. This would require that landlords provide that information each time they notify the tenant of changes. So these bills, of course, will have to be considered by the full council, but because the council has already started the budget process, they may not come up for a vote until early December by the full council. And this week also, Shama Sawant introduced her bill for rent control in her committee. I just want to go over some of the terms of that bill. It would place a cap on rent increases equal to the increase in the consumer price index for urban wage earners and clerical workers for the Seattle-Tacoma-Bremerton area over the past 12 months. That's often referred to as the CPI-W versus the CPI-U, which is more commonly used. The CPI-W is being used in this case because it tracks the wages of blue-collar workers and price increases for them and what they spend their money on. For all of 2018, that increase would be 3.36%, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So that would be the cap under Sawant's rent control ordinance. That would be the highest amount that a landlord could increase your rent for the coming year. Now, rent can't be reset when a tenant moves out, so there can be no big jumps in between tenancies, which is very common.
And that's a big deal.
Yeah, that's a very big step. Now, if utilities are included, then the amount for utilities can't be higher than the average utility bill for that unit over the past 12 months. Another thing that's in there, it requires one-for-one replacement of units at the same rent if an old apartment building is torn down and replaced with a new apartment building. The only adjustment that can be made is for the size of the unit. If, for example, the old building had smaller units and the new building had bigger ones, or vice versa, as it more commonly is, the older building had bigger units and the new building had smaller units, the landlord can adjust the rent based on the unit size, but they have to offer the same number of units in the new building at the same rent as the old building. And if they have any additional units, say, for example, the old building had 50 units, the new building had 100, then those 50 additional units can be rented out at any price. But that first year, but after that first year of setting any price on those units, they would still be subject to the rental cap going forward. And that's a big deal. Now, when landlords register a unit with the city's rental inspection program, the landlord must also disclose the amount of rent charged over the previous 10 years for that unit if it's not a brand new unit. And each city council district would have its own rent control board, and each board would consist of 5 renters and 1 landlord from within the district. The boards would hear petitions for exemptions to the rent cap, because there could be exemptions. For example, if there was major flood damage to a building, then a landlord might need to charge higher rent in order to repair that damage. The boards could also evaluate the annual rent cap and could recommend a higher amount if necessary. And they would advise the city council on issues related to rent control.
Would that be where landlords could go if, for example, they did a major upgrade to a unit? If, for example, between tenants, they say redid the kitchen or something like that, and it was a more valuable unit because of that. How does that fit in?
I think that's one of the issues that landlords have with the bill, is that they're not sure about what qualifies as allowable for the exemption. I think the exemption only is for extraordinary things. I don't think it includes those kinds of upgrades.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly doesn't include replacements. So, for example, if your refrigerator dies in your unit and your landlord replaces it, they can't automatically jack up your rent for that.
Because I know with a lot of the older units in this city, that are, for instance, need electrical work or plumbing work or, mm-hmm. or things like that, a lot of that work is done between tenants.
Yeah.
And it does increase the value of the unit.
Yeah, in some cases it does. In other cases, you could argue you're just upgrading, you're just making a replacement because things wear out over time.
Yeah.
So that's the issue with that clause. Sure. of the ordinance. And there's going to be some fights over
that.
Yeah,
there'll be some pushback on that, I'm
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there are other big criticisms, too, that landlords have of the bill. The first and foremost one is that they say the rent cap is too low. You know, although I went back over my own rent over the past 9 years, I've been a renter since I was about 18 or 19 years old. And I had records over at least the past 9 years, that were easy and quick for me to find. My rent has increased 27.8% over those past 9 years, and that averages out to about 3.1% a year.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go. And you know, I have a big corporate landlord, so I'm sure I'm not getting any special break on my rent there. And I want to point out too that in that same time period, over that same 9 to 10 years, overall price inflation in Seattle increased by 20%. Not 27.8% like my rent did.
Yeah, you know, the rent's been going up in the city much higher than the cost of living overall.
Yeah.
Because cost of living doesn't include housing costs. Mm-hmm. It doesn't include a lot of basic costs that blue-collar people pay.
Yeah, I think that depends on what statistics you're looking at.
Yeah, sure.
Some folks would say, well, yeah, things are built in there, but rent is often taken out of there with the idea that rent fluctuates so much. And I think with the acknowledgement that economists have that if you track rent, it's going to skew the statistics enormously. So they just kind of take for granted the fact that rent is based on what the market will bear, and that developers and landlords just jack up the rent as high as they think they can. Now, the other criticism that landlords have of Sawant's rent control bill is that they'll always be at least 1 year behind with utility costs if they include utilities in the rent. But I want to point out that most landlords in Seattle now make you pay separately for utilities, and they don't include it in the rent. It's just really common. It's been really common in the last 15 years in particular for even older buildings, landlords to say, okay, these are my utility costs. I'm just going to base a square foot amount on that, and you pay it separately. That's really common now. And then finally, developers are deeply opposed to the one-for-one replacement of units because it requires them to include affordable housing anytime they tear down an older apartment building. Of course, the upside is that it provides an incentive to preserve older, more affordable housing, and it could put a halt to the rapid pace of redevelopment and gentrification in Seattle. So I think that's going to be an issue for them, is that one-for-one replacement requirement and the issue of what do you mean exactly by exemptions to the rent cap and what can be included in that.
And, of course, the elephant in the room is that rent control is still illegal at the state level.
Yes.
And so if this passes, it requires that the city go and lobby the state for an exemption to that.
Yeah, for the state legislature to pass a repeal of the ban on rent control. Or it could lead directly to a court case. I'm sure there will be landlords who are lining up to sue if the city does pass a rent control bill. And, of course, the city's Sawant, at least, is looking forward to that, I think, taking this before the state Supreme Court and hoping that they will overturn the ban on rent control.
And the state legislature also, given to the California and Oregon have both passed variations on bills like that to address their affordable housing.
Yeah, New York, California, I think Chicago also has a version of rent control. Other big cities have instituted rent control. And while opponents of rent control say, oh, those bills don't work, I think it depends on who you ask. Yeah. If you ask the tenants of those rent-controlled units, they will tell you, oh, yeah, rent control works, and it's great.
Yeah, doesn't work necessarily for landlords that are counting on extortionary profits. But it does work well for tenants.
Yeah, it works very well for tenants, depending on how you structure it.
All right. And I would expect then outside interests would be weighing in on this as well. I mean, watching it closely.
They're going to be watching it closely. But like I say, the budget process has started, and this bill has just been introduced in Sawant's committee, has not been voted, even discussed really much in her committee or voted out of committee. It's, that's going to have to wait till early December, and I doubt there will be time in December for it to pass the city council.
Yeah, in which case we'll have to start all over again in January.
Much of it depends on whether Sawant is reelected, I think. If she is reelected, we can see further action on this bill in early 2020. If she's not reelected, it's not probably going to go anywhere.
At least for the coming year.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Mayor Durkan rolled out her budget this week.
Yeah, we're slowly getting in drips and drabs. Mayor Durkan's budget proposal. She's doing it sort of one department at a time.
Well, she did that, but on Monday she released her full budget.
Yes.
Yeah. And some highlights of the proposed 2020 budget include, and I read through the executive summary to see what is she really pushing, and putting forward in her budget, and she puts front and center the sale of the Mercer Mega Block.
Yeah, and that's a lot of the transportation issues too.
Yeah, she said she immediately talks about $78 million of the proceeds going to affordable housing. She buries a little further back in the executive summary the $50.7 million for transportation. There's a reason for that. the proceeds for housing are going to go into four different places. $15 million is designated for Equitable Development Initiative, which is supposed to help residents, businesses, and cultural organizations at risk of displacement from gentrification. Past recipients of that money include the Chief Seattle Club, Africa Town, the African Women Business Alliance, United Indians of All Tribes, and the Refugee and Immigrant Family Center to build things like senior housing, childcare centers, affordable commercial space, community centers and affordable housing, that kind of thing. $15 million is going to fund affordable homeownership via a community land trust model. and we know that a lot of money will go into that for just very few homes for people who need family-style housing.
Yeah, and they're typically first-time house buyers.
Yeah, it's a good idea. It's not necessarily a way to house a lot of people quickly. $6 million is going to go for a low-cost loan program to help lower-income homeowners build accessory dwelling units. Excuse me. And the remaining $42 million will be kept in the city's bank account, waiting to be spent on affordable housing that will be publicly owned. Now, over the next few months, Mayor Durkin is planning to propose working with the city council to identify properties to buy, to run them by a panel of quote-unquote community experts and stakeholders, and then have the council vote on legislation to acquire those properties for the city to manage and run as permanent affordable housing. So in the next few months, that $42 million from the Mercer Mega Block is...
Keep an eye on it because it may or may not get transferred to another project.
So first off, I found this really funny, given that the Seattle Housing Authority has sold off large chunks of public land over the past decade that was formerly used for low-income housing and is now either was either sold at market rates or is now renting out at either market rates or to people who make 80 to 120% of area median income. Yeah, that includes large portions of their High Point, Rainier Vista, Holly Park, which is now called New Holly, and Yesler Terrace development. Large chunks of that land has been sold off to private developers. In the next few months, there's going to be an opportunity here, I think, for Seattle residents to weigh in on how this money will be spent and who these projects are going to serve with this $42 million.
And that really critically underscores the importance of the upcoming city council elections.
It does, yeah. Now, as Job said, the rest of the Mercer Mega Block proceeds are going to go for transportation projects. Two-thirds of that money is already spoken for, a large chunk to pay down the debt on the Mercer Corridor Beautification Project, which has largely benefited developers in the South Lake Union neighborhood. That chunk is going to be $12.2 million.
But it fixed the gridlock.
Oh, yeah, no.
Made it permanent.
Yeah. Yeah, another chunk.
And if you're in the 25th floor with no windows that open, then you don't get the carbon monoxide.
Right.
It's all good.
Yeah. So another large chunk will fill the hole in the operations budget for the South Lake Union streetcar to the tune of $3.6 million. Another chunk will fund planning for the city center streetcar. That's $9 million. And yet another chunk is going to fill in the gap in the transportation budget left by declining parking tax revenue. That's $9.2 million.
And the declining parking tax revenue comes in large part because the city is eliminating parking spaces.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And encouraging people not to drive. So that's a dying source of revenue for the city. Now, out of $50.7 million set aside for transportation, that leaves just $16.7 million, or one-third of it, for new transportation projects. And Durkin is saying it'll be spent on things like bike lanes, new sidewalks and curb ramps, sidewalk repairs, and traffic calming.
Yeah, and she's not specifying exactly what projects that'll
go
to.
Yeah, and the city's had a pretty poor track record of promoting bike lanes, for example, so I'm not sure that we can necessarily trust that that's what the money will be spent for. Now, some other highlights of the budget. Durkin makes a big deal over the additional revenues that the city is collecting from the sweetened beverage tax, about $6 million more than the city had anticipated or budgeted for. This time, instead of using that money to fund a bunch of existing programs so that Durkin could free up money for her other priorities, including expanding the navigation team like she did in the last budget, Durkin is proposing now that, oh yes, okay, I will follow the city council's directions when they passed a bill earlier this year.
In other words, the law.
Yeah, the city council passed a bill earlier this year to set the sweetened beverage tax money aside in its own fund and spend it solely on food programs and early childhood education programs. So Durkin is proposing that it be used for that this time around. So that fight is not going to happen again this year like it did last year. Now, as for the police department, Durkin is allocating $850,000 to continue the emphasis patrols that started in May of this year. I think you'll remember that they were initially called pre-summer emphasis patrols, and they were a way to corral homeless people out of sight for the summer tourist season. Now Durkin wants to make them a permanent feature, but they'll be staffed, of course, by cops who are working overtime at overtime pay, which makes me think, wow, this is a sweet permanent deal for the police department and for cops who want to boost their salaries.
It also underscores that the city's approach to homelessness is basically a whack-a-mole of, you know, move them around, try and keep them out of sight,
Yeah.
And that doesn't really solve anything. It also forces the police to become first responders in many cases and social service workers, because the social service workers that actually are part of the budget you know, those positions are underfunded. They turn over rapidly, and they're not very effective.
We need more of them.
Yes.
And that $850,000 would be better spent getting folks on the street who can offer services, or spent on the services that homeless folks need,
yeah,
like drug treatment programs, mental health services.
And if you're doing it as overtime pay, then aren't you spending 50% more than you need to if this mm-hmm. was just part of the regular
job? Yeah, this was just part
job.
Of the regular
job. Well, and also police officers make a lot more than caseworkers do.
Oh, yes, they do. Now, another portion of her budget is, and we talked about this last week, I think, her high barrier individuals, her plan to deal with high barrier individuals, which we were just talking about. Her proposal to spend $5 million on four programs to deal with frequent offenders, people who are often homeless, who commit a lot of petty property crimes and who have drug addictions and or severe mental health issues. And last week we talked about how those four programs that she's proposing to spend $5 million on are not necessarily going to be effective in helping those homeless people get off the street or become sober, or help them with their mental health issues, or even reduce the property crimes that the programs are meant to reduce.
I'm waiting for next year's budget when she'll offer free bus tickets out of state.
Yeah, unfortunately that may be coming. Now,
I think King County is handling that, aren't they?
Yeah, that was a proposal by one of the King County Council
Reagan
members.
Dunn.
Yeah, one of the conservative ones. Yeah, rather than consolidate Seattle and King County's homelessness services together in one regional authority, Reagan Dunn proposed, let's just fund a whole bunch of bus tickets to send homeless people out of town, which I think is probably the most horrible thing I've heard in a long time out of his mouth. Now, the Human Services Department in the city budget, Durkin has the navigation team listed under the Human Services Department, even though we all really know that it belongs under the Police Department. She's proposing that last year's expansion of the navigation team, which was funded with a one-time funding allocation, she's proposing that be made permanent. Now, the budget...
And remember, the navigation teams at this point are primarily used to facilitate sweeps.
Yeah, just to push people around the city, not to get people into housing. Because we don't have the housing and we don't have the treatment programs for them.
The affordable housing doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And as you say, social services are vastly underfunded as well.
Yeah. Now, the budget also allocates $2 million to help set up the new Seattle-King County Regional Homelessness Agency, even though the city council and the county council have yet to vote on that proposal. And they could possibly amend it in some very important ways. There was, I think, the first hearings on it this week. Lisa Herbold raised some issues on why the city of Seattle is putting the bulk of the money into the regional agency to fund salaries. And King County's contribution to the regional homelessness agency is some office space, rent-free, and a few tenant improvements, which are a one-time expense. That's their contribution.
How does any of that get homeless people off the streets?
Well, yeah, and it's also fiscally irresponsible for the city council or the mayor to support a policy that sets up a regional agency where the city is responsible for 100% of the salaries of the people who staff the department. That is fiscally irresponsible. So like I say, there are going to be some big amendments, I think, to this going forward. And Durkin is assuming it's just going to go forward as planned. I don't think so.
No.
Now, overall... Oh, did you have something you wanted to say, Mike?
No,
so overall, all departments in the budget are going to get an increase in funding. The total budget is $6.5 billion, which is 8.5% higher than in 2019. A large chunk of that, though, is the one-time revenue from the Mercer Mega Block sale. If you back that out, the general fund budget is about 3.5% higher than 2019. And that tracks really consistently with the increases in prices in the Seattle area over the past year. So this budget, even though it looks like it's hugely higher than last year, it's not wildly overblown. It's just that the Mercer Mega Block sale proceeds really skew the total, making it look like it's a lot higher than last year. And I think that's why we really want to keep a close eye on where that Mercer money is going to be spent, because you don't get that kind of windfall every year.
Yeah, and Durkin has a track record of shifting things from one project to another.
Yeah, and you'd hope that the city is going to be responsible and spend it on projects that have a lasting impact and not just kind of throw it at things that are little one-time fixes that aren't going to be helpful to anybody.
And given that Mercer Mega Block sale was chosen over affordable housing options that would have been much better for affordable housing, one would hope that some of that money is going to go into actual affordable housing.
Actual good long-term affordable housing, particularly that $42 million for the city to buy properties and develop and manage properties. I think we have to look and watch that very closely. I also am really concerned about the money, the transportation piece that's going into the streetcar system, particularly backfilling the hole in the South Lake Union streetcar budget and planning for a city center connector streetcar that isn't going to be a viable transportation alternative in the future.
Yeah, I don't think any of the streetcars are a viable transportation alternative at this point.
But it's going to be up to the city council. They're going to be going through a number of hearings looking at the different portions of the budget in the coming weeks. And you can visit the city council website. And I would pay close attention to the housing portions of the budget, the human services department portions, and the portion that deals with the transportation budget.
And the police also.
Yeah, and the police. Although there aren't a whole lot of new changes to that other than funding the emphasis patrols on a permanent basis.
And the navigation team further.
Yeah, that's
funding.
Part of the human services budget. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it seemed to me when I was first taking a quick overview of this that a bunch of these proposals she's putting out seem to play very well in a year that's an election year with, the city council.
Mayor Durkin supporting the chamber of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce candidates who are opposing current city council members like Lisa Herbold and Shama Sawant.
It just seemed like a lot of these play well with the chamber.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Chamber approved.
Yeah, yes.
Perhaps.
They may well have written portions of that budget.
Oh. I don't know how you can say things like that.
Oh, that's so cynical, Jeff.
I know.
But you notice I'm laughing like I believe it's true.
Yeah, well, the cynical comments on this show are really out of line. I understand that.
Oh, yeah, we never do that.
Yeah, enough of that. Okay. Let's move on. And Washington State's Attorney General.
Was one of 17 state attorney generals that sued the Trump administration again, this time over the weakened Endangered Species Act rules that were announced last August. Those rules would have required that the federal government take into account economic considerations for the first time when deciding whether to list a species as endangered. And that would really, really seriously gut the Endangered Species Act in a way that's never happened before. So expect a judge to be ruling on that sometime soon. And these kind of proposals from the Trump administration have not fared well in the courts. The state attorney generals that have made a habit of suing the Trump administration have also made a habit of winning those cases, including Bob Ferguson, Washington State's attorney.
Bob Ferguson's been very careful to select cases that he feels he can win, and he's had a really good track record so far.
Yes, he has. And some other states are taking the lead on this one, particularly California, I think Maryland and Massachusetts also, and New York. But Washington State, of course, has joined and taken the lead in a lot of these cases. So we'll keep an eye on that for sure.
Yeah. Mr. Ferguson has had a lot of material to work with.
Yes.
with this president.
Yes, uh-huh. He's kept busy, for sure.
All right. Well, anything else on that?
No, we should remind people that if you enjoy our cynical comments and the information that you get from this show, KODX is a volunteer, all-volunteer station, and we rely on your contributions to keep us going. So if you find the information valuable that you hear on this show and all the other great shows that you hear on Saturdays and during the week, send us some money. We could use it. There's a Patreon button on the website that you may well be looking at and listening to right now.
There's also a PayPal button for one-time donations if you scroll down to the bottom of the site. And you can mail us a check, make out the check to Earth on the Air, Independent Media, and mail it to P.O. Box
45883.
That's Mike's time to shine, everybody.
Seattle, Washington, 98145.
Yes. So throw us some coin. We could use it. Mm-hmm. We really appreciate it. And thank you to the people who have already donated. And
it's a great way to support independent media that is locally based and covers local issues.
Absolutely.
And that is getting rarer and rarer as time goes on.
And as there are fewer full-time reporters in the city.
Yeah.
And we're also always open to your tips and suggestions that you can email us at contact@kodxseattle.org. We're also looking for volunteers to help on recording and production and things like that. So,
if you have any experience or if you just want to learn, contact us.
Oh yeah, we'll train you.
So, sticking with the Trump administration, they were getting a little bit of media coverage this week.
They didn't have a very good week, did they?
No.
Let's the Trump presidency basically imploded this week with the House Democrats announcing a formal impeachment inquiry, and that is moving very rapidly in terms of subpoenaing witnesses and documents.
Yeah, and I think Nancy Pelosi really had to announce a formal impeachment, because otherwise there would have been a complete revolt within the Democratic Party and a replacement of some folks in the leadership if she hadn't.
And the fact that she has decided to back the impeachment, however reluctantly, gave it additional weight, I think.
Yeah.
Because she'd been so publicly skeptical.
Been very cautious up to this point.
Yes. There are now, I think, 224 members of the House that have publicly backed an impeachment inquiry. That is a absolute majority of the House. If that number voted for impeachment articles, that would actually go to the Senate at that point.
Mm-hmm,
And they're looking at a timeline of trying to get that done by Thanksgiving, one way or another. It doesn't necessarily mean they will recommend out articles of impeachment, but they do have a whole lot of material to work with, including the things that Trump has himself admitted to. And this week, that reaches a crescendo with his information on the whistleblower complaint that was made public this week, involving his phone call to the Ukrainian president, which we talked about last week, and the way the administration handled the notes from that phone call, which was to try to bury them in a top-secret separate server, usually used for sensitive intelligence matters of national security.
The whistleblower complaint actually says that that was not the first time that the Trump administration had buried transcripts of the president's talks and his phone calls in order to avoid political embarrassment.
And we got another report from the Washington Post yesterday that may well have been one of those previous incidents. Mm-hmm. We don't know for sure, but that goes back to early 2017, in May of 2017, the day after James Comey was fired, when, as people may remember, although it's hard to keep track with everything that happens on a daily and weekly and monthly basis with the Trump administration, that was the time that he invited in a couple of high-ranking members, an ambassador and a associate
ambassador
minister.
Ambassador Kislyak.
Yes.
Sergei Kislyak.
And invited them
Russia.
Into the Oval Office, and nobody found out until Russian media reported it out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the same time, the same meeting in which Trump blurted out classified information involving Israeli intelligence embedded in ISIS, which was not something Russia was supposed to know, or anybody for that matter.
Yeah.
But in that same meeting, it turns out that Trump told the Russians, "Oh, I'm fine with your election meddling last time." He basically gave
in
them
the green U.S. light. Election.
In the U.S. election, yeah. He had no problem with
because
it.
Because we do that in other countries around the world.
Yeah. So
essentially giving the Russians the green light that we were not going to protest if they interfere in any elections, not just our own, but any other nation's elections around the world.
Although, and it also does explain why Trump has been so reluctant to, and the Republicans and McConnell in the Senate in particular have been so reluctant to enact, protections for foreign meddling in elections, particularly on social media, and protecting state and county level databases and voter systems. So it explains a lot, but you have to wonder what else has been buried in that way. And that's certainly something that the House Intelligence Committee wants to find out. They issued a protection order Thursday, I believe, that ordered the Trump administration not to destroy any of that evidence. We'll see whether the Trump administration honors that, since they don't seem to be very concerned about following the law, but it is a legally binding order. So we'll hopefully find out some of that information in the coming weeks. It's going to take some time to get to the bottom of this, because there's a whole lot of other shoes that I think are ready to drop on this.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting, I want to talk about a couple things. In the transcript of the phone call,
yeah,
that's at issue between Donald Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky, the newly elected president of Ukraine.
Oh, that was a rich transcript.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
We don't know. It's not a full transcript.
It's not,
though.
Yeah.
It's a partial transcript.
But it looks fairly accurate.
Yeah, but even what the White House released, one of the things that
incredibly damning.
Yeah, one of the things that I saw in there is that at one point Zelensky kissed up to Trump by saying that he had stayed at Trump Tower when he was in New York City, which I think is an absolutely direct instance in which Trump is accepting an emolument from a foreign leader.
Absolutely.
In exchange for political favors that foreign leader is hoping to get from him. And I don't think it can get any clearer than that.
Yeah.
That's not something that's been talked about much.
There's a couple other things that I wanted to highlight from that haven't been talked a lot much. Mm-hmm. One was the exchange that has been mentioned a lot, in which Zelensky mentioned that he really wanted to buy anti-tank missiles from the United States, because of course he's dealing with a Russian invasion in his eastern provinces, and you know, any other president would take that as a green light. Arms sale? We need to do that. Absolutely. Instead, Trump pivots to his "yes, but I have a favor to ask" mob moment. But
oh, yeah.
He ignored the potential.
I would like you to do us a favor, though.
Yes,
is what he says.
Yes.
Immediately after
and,
that.
And there's a lot of work in that though that's being done. But in addition to that favor that he asked, which was of course to investigate Joe Biden and his son,
mm-hmm.
He also made a couple of other requests in that phone call. One is a right-wing conspiracy theory that's being backed by the Russian government that's trying to blame election meddling in 2016 on the Democrats and centering in Ukraine rather than Russia.
Yeah.
This is a narrative that's being pushed by Russia, and it smacks of something that Putin asked Trump to do, and then Trump in exchange is asking Zelensky to do. It's a right-wing conspiracy theory in the United States that's trying to shift any kind of blame away from the Trump campaign in 2016 and onto the Democrats, which of course is absurd.
Yeah, and away from the Russians as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, no, and it's really centered in this dispute within the Ukraine between rival politicians, some backed by Russia, and some that are trying to get those guys out of power.
Yes.
And Trump has just bought it hook, line, and sinker and gone down the rabbit hole of this baseless conspiracy theory. And it's now affecting, this is part of the whistleblower complaint, it's now affecting his foreign policy decisions and has his allies in the State Department and the CIA deeply concerned, which is why we got this whistleblower complaint
yes.
in the first place.
Well, that and the fact that he was withholding the military aid to Ukraine, which mm-hmm. had already been approved by Congress, he's basically using congressionally approved military aid as a bargaining chip to extort Ukraine for personal gain.
Yeah,
and that's the heart of the impeachment inquiry.
Yeah, and the whistleblower complaint makes it clear that in spite of what Donald Trump is saying, that he had nothing to do with holding up the military aid for Ukraine, that yes, indeed, Donald Trump did make the decision himself to withhold that military aid,
yeah.
and that he did it on July 18th before the phone call with Zelensky, and that order came directly from the president.
Yes. And that was reported out earlier this week as well.
Yeah. So those are some of my takeaways from reading that complaint, what's been, you know, declassified, and reading the text of the phone call that's been declassified.
And I would highly recommend, if people haven't done it already, to go and read that complaint. Mm-hmm. It's very readable, it's very well laid out, and it is really damning.
Yeah. Although you can get kind of tangled up in who are all these guys in the Ukraine, but it really makes the point once you start looking at who are all these names of these people in Ukraine that Rudy Giuliani has talked to and who's saying what about who within the Ukraine, it really makes clear that Donald Trump's just gone down this rabbit hole and is now believing all these lies that are being slung back and forth between these Ukrainian rivals, and that is really influencing his decisions about foreign policy in a way that's really scary.
Yeah, and the other thing that came out of sort of Trump taking sides with the Russian-aligned factions in Ukraine mm-hmm. is the effort to rehabilitate Paul Manafort, who worked with those rivals, and is, of course, now he pled guilty, and Trump is trying to set up that he actually wasn't guilty at all, which is absurd, because Manafort was convicted in large part for not reporting to the IRS all the money that he was funneling from the Ukraine.
And they have the financial records.
And, they're trying to make the case that the financial records were illegally obtained or something, which doesn't really get...
To the guilt.
Doesn't take away the guilt there. And, to rehabilitate Manafort properly, you would have to make the case that he wasn't paid for his work in the Ukraine, so he didn't funnel any money back into the U.S., because that's what he was convicted of. Mm-hmm. And all those designer suits and property, luxury properties that he bought with cash, with that money to try and launder that cash, it never existed. That's the case that you would have to make, mm-hmm. and I don't think they're going to make it very well.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
Well, I think that this whole constellation of stories around the Ukraine and foreign policy and what Trump has been burying is going to dominate news cycles pretty much for the next several months. So we're going to have plenty of time to talk about it in the future.
Yeah.
Okay.
Meanwhile, the Trump administration is still doing what the Trump administration does, which is to inflict lasting damage on the federal government and the rest of us.
Yes, which I think will also be dominating news cycles.
I want to talk a little bit about... the Trump administration cutting the number of refugee visas to 18,000 per year from 30,000.
Okay, case in point.
Yep.
Yeah, it's now it's now a fraction of the 110,000 that were refugees that were allowed into the United States under Obama per year. The Trump administration officials said that they're doing this because so many people are now seeking asylum that they can't also process refugees. But I want to point out that, yes, there is a backlog of 1 million asylum cases in the system, but that's because the Trump administration is not quickly evaluating asylum claims. Refugees, on the other hand, come to the U.S.'s shores already evaluated and screened.
Yeah, it's a separate system.
They don't go through the same system as the asylum folks do. So the fact that he's just cutting the number of refugees down to a tiny fraction of what it was just 2 or 3 years ago is really, I think, mean and racist and a sign that Stephen Miller, his leading champion within the White House of shutting the doors into the U.S. and not allowing anyone in, is winning.
Yeah. So watch what they say. Watch what they do. Actually, not what they say.
Now, on the other hand, there were two court decisions this week that went against the Trump administration on their immigration policies. Judge Kentoji Brown Jackson of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia put a nationwide injunction in place on the Trump administration's fast-track deportation program, which would deport any undocumented person who's been living in the U.S. for less than 2 years without allowing them a lawyer or a hearing before a judge. Judge Jackson basically said, well, you're just completely violating these people's civil rights, and I can't allow this to go forward because you haven't even addressed some terrible issues that are already occurring within the fast-track deportation program that operates along the border. You cannot, and so I'm not going to allow you to expand it to the entire country and just to deport people who have been here less than 2 years.
Well, violating their civil rights is kind of the point.
Yeah. Now, in the second court decision, Judge Dolly Gee of U.S. District Court in Los Angeles ruled that the Trump administration can't throw out the Flores Agreement entirely and hold children and parents in custody indefinitely. Basically, that's what the Trump administration is trying to argue. Please, Judge, let us just completely ignore the Flores Agreement. And Judge Dolly Gee says, what about my past decisions do you not understand here? Yeah.
They can't just
throw out the Flores Agreement. No.
They have been ignoring the Flores Agreement in the field for the last 3 years.
Yeah. So the Trump administration's running up against court cases that are stopping a lot of the policies that a lot of the very inhuman immigration policies that they've been putting into place.
And that's taking into account that the Senate has been confirming in record numbers ideologically sympathetic judges, and they're still losing those court cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
And didn't they? Wasn't the court put a stop to the use of military funds for the wall this week? I thought I saw that.
I think that was last week.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe that was this week. But yeah.
It's all running together.
No, there have been several court cases. I think there are states that are saying, look, you can't
actually,
just...
Actually, it wasn't a court case. I believe it was actually Senate. But
the Senate, yeah.
But a temporary...
No, there are several local jurisdictions that are saying, look, you know, we need this money, for example, to repair military bases that have been damaged by flooding due to global warming,
yeah,
et cetera.
And schools.
And
daycare centers
and veteran health care, things like that. You know, you can't just take that money and use it to build the border wall.
Yeah. And the international money that was diverted to build the border wall primarily came out of the fund that was created to stop Russian aggression in Eastern Europe. And that is.
Why are we not surprised?
Yeah. And that is being challenged as well.
Uh-huh.
Also, the Senate this week came out with a report regarding the NRA.
Yeah. The Senate Finance Committee. Came out with a report on the NRA and its role in 2016 in the election, and said that they were basically acting as a Russian asset. And this goes back to Maria Butina and Alexander Torchin infiltrating the NRA, introducing Russians through the NRA to senators and policymakers, and funneling money into the Trump campaign to the tune of millions and tens of millions of dollars.
Through the NRA's PAC,
yes.
Right?
Yes. And so, which is, of course, totally illegal. And underscores that Trump was coordinating money as well as other issues with the Russians in the 2016 campaign, and he's trying to do the same thing again with Ukraine in 2020. He's basically using the same playbook that he tried to use in 2016, which is shocking, actually, but also not surprising given that he doesn't have a whole lot of.
Well, it worked the first time.
It did. So why not try it again?
Yeah.
That report is going to cause a lot of problems for the NRA, which is being investigated by several state attorneys general, and particularly the New York Attorney General, which has jurisdiction over their tax-exempt status because they're registered as a tax-exempt corporation in the state of New York. And that's being challenged because nonprofits under the federal law cannot be involved in an electioneering, and they certainly can't be involved in funneling foreign money into an election campaign, any election campaign for a federal office, let alone the presidential race. So the NRA is in a world of hurt, and they may well lose their tax exempt status, which they're already struggling financially and have had a lot of internal problems the last couple of years as well with various revelations that their executive leaders have been, you know, living luxurious lives on the backs of people who are donating to ostensibly protect gun rights. So the NRA is not what it used to be in terms of a lobbying force on Capitol Hill, and that's going to continue to have problems over the next couple of years.
I just looked it up real quick. It was the U.S. Senate voted 54-41 on Wednesday to end the declaration of national emergency and stop the diversion of military funds to pay for the U.S.-Mexico border wall, but it's expected to be vetoed by...
None too soon.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the second time they've done that.
Yeah.
Yes. It'll be the second time
Trump
he'll veto it.
Will veto it, yeah.
All right.
Yes.
Also this week, Bernie Sanders comes up with a proposal for a wealth tax.
Yeah, he did. Elizabeth Warren really has been known as the wealth tax guru because she rolled out her plan in January to tax not just the incomes, the annual incomes of rich people, but their net wealth or the value of the total value of what they own each year. Now, this week, Bernie Sanders rolled out his own version of a wealth tax, which would almost double the amount that Warren would collect under her plan. Now, the tax would apply, Sanders tax, would apply to households with a net worth above $32 million. That's about 180,000 different households in the United States, or about the top 0.1% of the richest Americans. It would be a graduated tax of from 1% up to 8% on net worth that's over $10 billion. And yes, there are people
who
quite
own
a bit
higher rate
more than
$10
billion. Yeah, that's a much higher rate. Now, for single filers, the tax would kick in at $16 million. And it would be an annual tax, again, not a one-time tax. So that 8% rate would gradually whittle down the assets of the very richest Americans in the United States. Warren's tax, on the other hand, is a 2% annual tax on net worth from $50 million to $1 billion. And then that goes up to a 3% tax on wealth over $1 billion. Again, an annual tax that would be charged every year. Under her plan, marital status wouldn't matter. It's just your holdings that matter. Sanders' plan would collect about $4.35 trillion over a decade, while Warren's plan would raise about $2.6 trillion, so about double what Elizabeth Warren has proposed. Sanders has talked. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Has he said how he wants to spend the revenue?
Yeah. Sanders, he has said that he would use the proceeds from the tax to fund universal child care. He also has a expansive housing plan for affordable housing that he would fund with it. And, of course, just as he said back in 2017, he listed the wealth tax as a potential income source to pay for Medicare for All. He has said that this time around, that he would use it to pay for Medicare for All. Now, Elizabeth Warren this week welcomed Sanders' proposal, saying that she hoped that the other candidates would also consider wealth tax, proposing wealth
My
taxes
breath.
As well.
I'm holding it.
Yeah. Now, the Biden team, on the other hand, is drawing up their own tax proposal, but they're not looking at a wealth tax at all. Instead, Biden is considering raising the corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%. And I just want to point out that it used to be 35% before the Trump tax cut was passed in 2017.
Are there any major corporations that actually pay 21%?
That's a good question. There may be some smaller ones. I don't know. I don't think the major corporations pay that.
The loopholes are the real issue there.
Yeah. And you know, the various Democratic candidates have talked about closing some of those loopholes.
Yeah.
But closing all of the loopholes would be a big lift, I think, they would require a lot of rewrites of the tax code.
Yes.
And it also would require an understanding of the tax code, which a lot of politicians don't have. Now, Biden has proposed...
And then we all have to pass through the Senate.
Yeah, it would. Now, Biden has proposed raising the capital gains tax rate on millionaires, although he has said that he wouldn't entirely get rid of the preferential rates for all investors on capital gains. That's any gain that you make from the sale of an asset like a stock or bond or gain on the sale of jewelry or anything that you own that's for investment.
Yeah, and that income is taxed at a lower rate than people
a much
actually,
lower rate
than people actually
than your wages.
Yes, wages or salaries. Yeah.
Yeah. Now Biden's been considering a tax on financial transactions like the sale of stocks and bonds, which would impact high frequency traders, I think, but not necessarily hit the richest Americans, and certainly not the richest Americans only. So that's a little bit problematic, putting a tax or a fee on the sale of stocks and bonds. And I should say overall, the tax proposals really differ between the candidates, but it's really fair to say that all the Democratic candidates would raise taxes in some way or another if they were elected president. And of course, wealthy Americans who have been the beneficiary of the Trump tax cuts, but also the earlier Bush era tax cuts, they will hopefully be the ones who would pay the most.
And the fact that the Trump tax cuts in particular have exploded the federal deficit, I think people are looking to balance those books a little bit.
Yeah. Now, of course, as Jav said, any tax increase is going to have to pass Congress, and that means that the Democrats are going to have to work really hard next year to try to get a majority in the Senate if they want any tax bill to pass.
Yeah, and even then they would have to abolish the filibuster.
It depends. If it were part of a budget bill, then the filibuster wouldn't matter.
But, that's true.
But if it were a standalone tax bill, you're right. They would need to get rid of the filibuster.
All right. Just about a minute or so to touch on the water crisis in Zimbabwe.
If you think we have it rough in Seattle, consider Harare, the capital of Zimbabwe, where people have had no water for the last week. The municipal water supply has been shut off by the government there because they have run out of money or currency to pay to import the chemicals for the water treatment plant. So they're trying to prevent a cholera outbreak. Now, preventing a cholera outbreak by leaving people to fend on their own for water supplies out of dirty toilets and
not a great policy.
Not a great policy
means
at
the,
all.
Means the folks with money can buy bottled water and folks without just scavenge.
Exactly. And the other factor that we should mention in there, particularly given the protests last week, is that sub-Saharan Africa is in the middle of a severe drought, and that is directly related to climate change. That part of the world is expected to have less and less access to rainfall and to fresh water in the coming decades. And that's going to be a serious humanitarian crisis that is already starting in the case of Zimbabwe and Harare is really impacting a couple million people that live in that area. And millions more that commute in and out and do business in the nation's capital there. So this is not a story that's getting a lot of play in American media because, of course, it's in sub-Saharan Africa, but it is a real harbinger of things to come and something well worth keeping an eye on.
It also makes me wonder, too, a little bit about the finances of Zimbabwe and which banks and which big financial institutions are making a profit off of major loans and debt that
they've extended to Zimbabwe. The International Monetary Fund is still a huge player in countries like that, and it's still a deeply corrupt system.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they're not the only ones. Western banks also loan to
Western banks, to the World Bank. Gets involved. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different institutions like that.
Yeah.
But the ones that the United States has disproportionate control over are both the Western banks. Really all of these: the Western banks, the International mm-hmm. Monetary Fund, etc.
Yeah. Events.
Yeah, we got to coming up tomorrow. There will be a People's Town Hall on nuclear weapons, co-sponsored by the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility and Washington Against Nuclear Weapons Coalition. That'll be at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca. Well worth checking out, 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And then tomorrow evening, Nuevo Amanecer, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, a social justice discussion and fundraiser for the new Don Guatemala community. That is something that's been supported by people here in Seattle for years, and it's a very worthy cause, particularly since Guatemala is, again, in the middle of a climate change-related drought. That'll be at 2210 North 184th Street in Shoreline, and you can look up details on the New Dawn Guatemala website or Facebook page.
Yeah. Also tomorrow is a counter-protest against racism, Just Say No to Racism, to counter a rally of racist hate groups planned for Westlake Park at 3 p.m. tomorrow. That's hosted by Black Lives Matter Seattle Original. And then on Tuesday, October 1st, is the delivery action for the People's Town Hall on nuclear weapons. You can join the monthly Seattle Anti-War Coalition rally at the Federal Building and deliver testimony to Senators Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell. That's 11 a.m. at the Federal Building at 2nd and Marion downtown.
Yeah, and that's something that'll be discussed at the Town Hall event tomorrow mm-hmm. afternoon.
more information on that if you go.
Yep.
All right.